back, little helpers. Today we have a really interesting topic. Of course, I think it's interesting because it relates heavily to borderline personality disorder, which is the disorder that all three of us on this call today have researched. So the third person on our call is Dr. Marcus Rodriguez. He is the Director of Global Mental Health Research Lab and the Associate Professor of Psychology at Pitzer College. He's also the founder and director of the Youth and Family Institute, as well as a trainer and consultant for Behavioral Tech, the training company founded by Dr. Marsha Linehan for the dissemination of DBT. And today he will be joining us to talk about chronic and traumatic invalidation. So Marcus, welcome. And can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm basically an academic sibling of both of yours. I think that's one place to start. We share the same mentor, Zach Rosenthal, and have trained in the same places. So I got my PhD at Duke, where you all recently were or currently are. I grew up in Mexico, lived in China for 10 years, 9 consecutively, and then 1 for my dissertation. And I live in LA. I have 2 kids, wonderful wife, and this is what I do now.
Marcus was a legend when he still is a legend, but when I came into the program, I remember Marcus was one of the ones who interviewed me, like on Skype at the time, and I remember I was asking, like, trying to be all like impressive. I was like, "Oh, what kind of research do you guys do? Like, tell me more about what you do in the lab." And Marcus very seriously said, "Well, we really want to try to monitor and understand people's behavior. So we're trying to put cameras in the trees and in your room so that we could videotape you guys at all times and develop therapy that way." Yeah, you did.
In an interview?
Yeah.
That sounds like hazing and unethical.
Totally. Yeah. And I was like, I gotta go to this lab. This is awesome. So yeah.
Yeah. Marcus is Zach's just pride and joy. Whenever a new student comes in, we hear like 1,000 stories about Marcus, to the point where we're like, shut the fuck up about Marcus, Zach. Like, So that just speaks to what a charming and charismatic guest we expect you to be today.
Marcus, how did you get to psychology and psychotherapy? And now you're doing like family work and you know, parenting and adolescence. So tell me how, that's not what you were doing at Duke. So I'm curious how you, how would you talk about your story?
I think that several times, many different times, and I imagine you had this experience doing DBT with folks in the Civitan, right, at the medical center there at Duke, and I would have clients that would say, "Oh my gosh, this is so helpful. I wish I knew this when I was 15. I wish I knew this when I was 16. And I just heard that so many times, where people would feel really, really grateful and simultaneously really sad that they had also in those 20 years made decisions that still have consequences, right? Sort of put limitations on what on the current life that we're trying to build for them. And I heard that a bunch of times, and I thought, like, oh shoot, I think I should work with like youth, with like teenagers. And but then I realized the reason that most people don't work with youth, what would you guess? I'm just curious, like, just...
They're difficult and don't want to be there?
Okay, yeah,
could be. I would guess that, yeah, they don't want to be there would be the main thing, right? Like...
Yeah, I would say it's not... Okay, so yes, that actually, for me, feels much more manageable. I think the hardest part is the parent work.
Yeah,
I think, like, emails from parents, because the parents are traumatized a lot of the times. The types of kids who need DBT, like, the parents have seen their kids get their stomachs pumped or, like, just, like, you know, like, stitched up their kid with, like, 19 stitches, you know, taken... I mean, they've seen and done things that feel really, really scary, so they're really anxious. So you just get a lot of anxious emails, anxious calls. The parents will basically, like, tell you how to do your job. And sometimes the recommendations make sense and they're helpful, but sometimes it's just coming from their own fears and it's they're not leading you towards evidence-based treatments. They're leading you basically to say, like, here's the way that we're trying to cope with this pain, fit into the system that we've already created that feels somewhat comfortable. And don't, you know, like, help us, but don't break these rules that we've come up with for our family and our system. And so working with parents was, like, I guess my journey then became, like, if I'm going to be able to help these kids, I have to figure out how to, like, collaborate with these parents, how to help them with their own anxiety, help them learn how to not only not get in the way of their kids' treatment, but to ultimately be, to support them, almost be like co-therapists. And because really, like, if we're going to help a kid build a life worth living, they do have so little control over their lives. They need collaborative problem solving with their parents. Like, if a kid decides, like, oh, my life worth living is that I got to switch schools, or I want to go into music, like, a 15-year-old can't do that on their own. They need some sort of caregiver that's going to support that. And so, so since then I got really into parent coaching, really into family therapy, because that was, like, a necessary part of helping kids. And the irony is, like, the first point you mentioned, Jacqueline, is I was like, oh, I heard so many times, like, oh, I wish, and they, my clients would say this with tears, they'd be like, I wish I knew this when I was 15. And then now that I'm working with 15-year-olds, they don't want it. And I'm like, I want to call those people back and be like, you know how you said you wish you had it? I think if I had met you when you were 15, you would have said no. But yeah, so I think, and yet it's, I think kind of the topic that we're talking about today, I think when someone is not motivated for treatment, right? Like, that's the judgment that we would put on it. I think that what it means is they're not on board with the plan that we have. We haven't, right? Like, our job as clinicians is to clearly assess the problem, to orient them to our understanding of the problem, and to offer solutions that might help with that, right? My job is not to motivate my client to do the hard work, right? And when we get stuck in that place where, like, our client is basically like, my therapist hasn't yet motivated me to do this work, and the parents are like, you haven't yet motivated my kid to do this work. And then what we often do as therapists is, like, we try harder and harder, and then the harder we try, the more passive they get. It's like, well, I mean, I guess Marcus hasn't figured it out yet. Like, once he figures it out, like, I'm gonna do the things. And really, the dialectic there is that both are true. Like, I do try really hard to motivate my clients, but ultimately I put motivation on them, and I say, my job is to assess the problem, orient you to it, offer solutions. And when we orient our client, like, a really good treatment conceptualization with potential solutions that are going to help, that is the most motivating thing. Like, that's what gets my even, like, 11-year-olds on board, when they hear a clear conceptualization of, this is what I think the problem is, and this is how I think we could solve it. And I think that a lot of times that there's, I don't know, like, we don't do that well enough. And then we blame our client for not being motivated, but it's because they're not, like, we haven't laid out a really clear plan of what it is that we're about to do and why we're going to do it, right? So that resistance, it just means the client's not on board. And if they're not on board, that means we probably didn't assess the problem well enough, or we didn't orient them to it clearly enough. And so instead we just jump to the conclusion of, they're not motivated, they want to change.
Yeah, that's helpful to conceptualize it that way, especially because with teens or with, you know, any client, there's that tendency to blame either the therapist or the patient of, like, oh, they're just difficult, or they don't want help, or they're impossible, right? There's just a lot of judgments where it's like, yeah, I mean, just having a clear plan and a really shared understanding of what you guys are doing would make a huge difference. Yeah. Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about, chronic and traumatic invalidation. Now I'm hearing so much in, like, TV shows and TikTok and everywhere, people are like, I want to be validated. I need to be validated. I don't feel validated. So validation is a word that now people are more familiar with, but I don't know if everyone knows what exactly it means and what it looks like. So can you tell us about, like, what traumatic or chronic invalidation looks like?
Yeah. I mean, like, validation is empathy expressed, right? Like, I can feel empathy for someone. Validation is where, like, I can see why what you're thinking, doing, feeling makes sense. And then I can reflect that to you in a way that you understand and and somehow communicates, like, I get it, like, I see it in some part of your experience, at least some part of it makes sense. And validation is that part where you just highlight the piece that does make sense. Invalidation then is, I guess it's where you do the opposite, where you tell people, like, what you're feeling, what you're thinking, what you want doesn't make sense, and it's not okay. So it's I don't know. I feel like folks probably have heard about this idea. It is all over TikTok now.
What are some different ways that can look? Like, is it always just know what you're feeling isn't right, or could neglect be a form of invalidation, physical abuse, etc.?
Yeah, it can. I mean, there's with it can look like all those things. It can look like people's, like, problem solving being minimized. And I literally just did it this morning. I feel so bad. I walked into my daughter's room, and it's like she has, like, all these, like, OMG dolls and a bunch of, like, Legos and then all these, like, plushy stuffies. And I got frustrated at her. I was like, why is your room so messy? I said, just clean it up. I said, just organize it. But, like, she's 10. She doesn't have those executive functioning skills to be able to organize, like, that many toys and to do it alone. But I said, just clean it up. It's not that hard. Get everything off the floor and everything off your desk. That's what I said. I said it in a way that was, like, not nice. I literally, like, this was like 10 minutes before our podcast, right? I was 5 minutes late because I was, like, practicing mindfulness. And Marcus, come into this place, like, be calm, be grounded. But actually, like, that is invalidation. It's like even, like, just minimizing the difficulty, the challenges, not acknowledging what someone is going through.
What would a validating way to have requested that have looked like?
Oh, it's so good. Thank you. I feel like I need this. I think probably I would have said, like, journey, like, I would have said, oh, I look at your room and I'm noticing that you don't tend to spend time in it. Right. So why don't you state the facts? Like, you're doing your homework downstairs. So I would describe how, like, she's not spending much time. And then I'd say, oh, I wonder if it's because your room is so messy. Right. And that's a judgment, but I would say there's so many things on the floor, it's hard to even walk in. And then I'd say that stresses me out. I would own that. I would say, like, that's on me. Like, it stresses me out to see your room like this. And I want it to be clean, right? I would own the part. Like, I wouldn't try to pretend, like gaslight her and be like, you want a really clean room. I'd just be like, I need the room to be clean because it's hard for me to feel super calm when I know that there's this one room in the house that looks like a bomb went off in it. And then I'd say, I know organizing a room is really, really hard, especially when you have as many things as you have. And it can feel overwhelming, and it's definitely not what you wanted to do this Saturday morning. I need you to do that this Saturday morning. And then for me as a parent to figure out what is realistic for her to do. So I'd say, all right, here's a box. I want you to put all of your OMG and LOL, you know, umbrella, the toys that fall under that umbrella, put them into this box so that we can, like, start categorizing and essentially deciding, like, what to do with them. And then I'll come back after the podcast and we can figure out next steps. So I think giving, like, a bite-sized task, saying, like, this is tough, acknowledging, I know you don't want to do this. And what's so tough about parenting and validating is that a lot of times people feel like it's hard to balance the validating with the limit setting. Like, I can validate and you're going to clean your room this morning, right? And it's really tough. I think we tend to, like, go to one extreme or the other where we're like, oh my God, it's so hard. I know. Let me just clean your room for you because it's so hard. Or we could, you know, we go to the extreme of just, like, clean it up, like, figure it out. Like, you're 10 now. Like, of course she's like, the irony is, yeah, you're 10. Exactly. Like, how would you know the systems? And so I think finding that balance is in my wise mind how I wanted to,
so
to speak to her.
That sounds beautiful, and it also sounds somewhat laborious to keep that up all the time. And so because I just imagine a lot of parents are just frazzled and go, 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 and they would say something like, just clean your room all the time. What's the difference between that and, like, chronic traumatizing invalidation?
Yeah. I think that the invalidation that is traumatizing It's interesting. I don't know, honestly. I think it's one of those things that you only know in retrospect. I imagine that you guys have covered the biosocial model at some point in one of your podcasts, right? So with the biosocial model, it's this idea of like there's some people who are more sensitive, right? Like meaning like a smaller stimulus can lead to an emotional reaction. They're more reactive when they do have an emotion. That means they have a bigger one. Like it goes from 0 to 10 pretty quickly, and then they have a slower time returning to baseline. When they get upset, it takes longer to calm back down. And there's just biological differences like between people in this way, including like impulsivity. But if you have someone who has this impulsivity plus slow return to baseline plus reactivity, like big emotions that are felt big in their body, plus sensitivity to like a small stimulus, and they don't have like super parents to be able to understand that, manage that, and still hold limits, then what the parents end up doing is the kid will have a big reaction because they're sensitive. Maybe like they're watching, I don't know, they're watching The Lion King, and then like Simba di no, Simba's the baby. Mufasa dies, right? And then all of a sudden the kid starts crying because Mufasa died. And there's like three kids watching it. One kid's crying, Mufasa died. And then the parents pause the movie, like he's okay, like he's gonna find Pumbaa and Timon, he's gonna get back together with his lady friend, and you tell him like it's gonna be good, and then like the other two kids kind of stop crying, but then the third one's like still crying, and you're like okay, like you press play, and you're like maybe he'll stop, and like still crying, so you like pause again, you're like dude, like it's just a cartoon, like this isn't actually a real movie, like it's not a real thing, there was no such thing as Simba and Mufasa and Scar, stop crying, and then all of a sudden you're like fine, like if you like you go to the kitchen, like cry it out until you can, and like because you're ruining movie night, like we're just trying to have a good time, so the kid goes into the kitchen, but then they're feeling super invalidated, they're feeling super unseen, unsupported, so then they start slamming counter like the shelves in the bathroom or in the kitchen or kicking stuff, and then the parent comes in, like what are you doing? You're acting fucking crazy, like. Stop. It's a cartoon. We're just having movie night with our family. Like, why do you have to act like this? Like, if you keep crying, I'm going to give you something to really cry about. And then all of a sudden, the kid, like, shuts down. And they're like, okay. Or at some point in this process, the kid shuts down, they stop crying. And the parents are like, oh, great. Like, I just helped them regulate their emotions. What actually happened was you just taught the kid to have shame about what it is that they're feeling and experiencing and how they're expressing that to know, like, I don't know what I should be feeling or doing or how I should be expressing it, but this is not the right way. And so they shut it down in shame. And the parents are like, okay, great, that worked. And now the kid over time is more sensitive, less trusting of their experiences because they're like, I don't know what I should be feeling. Like I certainly shouldn't have been feeling that. Like if I kept feeling and expressing that, I was gonna really get a reason to cry, whatever that means. And so it's this cycle where you've got a kid who's sensitive, who gets emotionally dysregulated, which then leads to inaccurate expression, right? Where they end up expressing themselves in some way that's not really effective. Which when the parents see that, then they get emotionally dysregulated. And in their emotion dysregulation, they invalidate the kid. They basically say, like, you shouldn't be feeling this. This is wrong. This isn't effective. And then when the kid gets invalidated, they are more emotionally dysregulated. So they express themselves less accurately. So then the parent gets more emotionally dysregulated. So they invalidate more. And when this cycle goes on for a long time, you eventually have what you would call like a pervasive history of invalidation, where it happens a lot. And a pervasive history of invalidation leads to a kid being more emotionally vulnerable. So that the next time a Mufasa dies or they watch Bambi and his mom gets shot or something, there's an even bigger reaction because there's this long-term history of invalidation that's through these cycles that happen. And so, right, but like the solution is like we need to teach the kid like how to use interpersonal effectiveness skills to like express themselves in ways accurate. We need to teach them mindfulness skills so that they can notice what judgments they're having that might be, you know, fueling their emotion and leading to the dysregulation. We need to teach them distress tolerance skills so that they can feel big emotions and not express themselves in a way that's inaccurate. And we've got to teach parents how to validate. And how to validate even when it's not easy. Like it's easy to validate if the kid walks into the house and they're like, oh my gosh, mom, I had such a hard day today. Like my friends planned this event to go to, I don't know, Disneyland, and they didn't invite me. And they're like, why? Oh, because there's only 3 seats in the car, and we were all talking and planning. And at the last minute, they decided like, okay, well, and then they were gonna do it without me. if a kid comes and says that, like, I think it's super easy for the parent to be like, oh my God, that's so sad, that's so hard, like, and I'm so sorry that happened. But if the kid walks in, throws their backpack on the chair, hits the dog, the dog like runs, and then they, you know, the parents are like, don't throw your, you know, don't, like, why are you treating our dog like that? And then they walk into the back, into their bedroom, and slam the door, and like a frame falls off the wall. The parents are like, what are you doing? You're acting like insane. Like, why are you bringing this energy into this house? Like, and the kid gets more invalidated. And so, yes, I think it's so hard. Like, I want to acknowledge, like, it's really hard for parents to validate when the kids are expressing themselves inaccurately, and often they are. And it's harder even when the parents have their own emotion dysregulation in that situation. It's harder when they have their own judgments that are fueling, right? The more, the higher emotion goes up, the more judgments we have, the more it fuels the, and so they have their own judgment. Like, why is my kid so, like, sensitive, so unreasonable, so selfish, so, like, whatever it is. And plus, the parents have their own vulnerabilities. Like, they had a headache, they had a stressful day. They're trying to, like, I don't know, they're trying to get into shape. Like, I did a bunch of push-ups last night, and now my back hurts. Like, you know, like, I would probably feel better if I hadn't done that. Like I have my own vulnerabilities. And, like, I slept weird, and it probably shouldn't do push-ups, is, I think, what my body is trying to say. So yeah, I'm just thinking this is where our kids find themselves. So this is the biosocial model, right? This idea of, like, sensitive kid who expresses themselves inaccurately, who then leads to parents getting dysregulated, and then leads to invalidation. And I guess I have so much I could say about this, but maybe I'll stop.
Yeah, I'm curious what that looks like over time, because even just, like, listening to that example, I was just like, geez, I mean, I think before I was a mom, I would have been like, oh yeah, you gotta validate, like, that poor kid, that, you know, it's so sad when Mufasa dies, of course. But that, now it's like, as a parent, you might want to just get the kid to school, you just want to get their pants on, you want to change their diaper, yes. And like 10 times a day, they're like acting, yes, like Mufasa just died over and over again. Yes. And I can understand why parents are just like, just put on the damn diaper. Yeah. So it's, I can imagine that this cycle with a kid who has, like, a lot of feelings could be so common, and yet sometimes, like, this cycle has disastrous outcomes, right? So, like, what does that look like when, and why? Like, how, you know, like, how does that become, like, a psychological problem? Like, what do we see in the clinic, or what do we see, like, in our friends and family that are...
Yeah. I think that, to answer that question, I want to take, like, another step back, because, and I'm going to answer that question. And I think about, like, when I was, like, it wasn't until recently that I had this new understanding of primary and secondary emotions that I think is central to understanding how do we respond when the kid doesn't want to put on their pants, or I don't know, whatever it is. You're like, I guess I'm curious, because I'm learning and trying to collect data. Like, what is your understanding of what is a primary and secondary emotion?
Primary emotion is the kind of emotion that's, like, linked pretty directly to what happens. So, like, if a dog chases you snarling, you feel fear. And then a secondary emotion is an emotion that might come from judgments around the primary emotion, or where the it's meant to mask the primary emotion. So, like, somebody feeling a lot of shame might have the secondary emotion, anger, because it's more, it feels better to be angry than to feel shame.
Yeah. Okay. Hmm. You probably paid better attention in Zach's classes than I did. Cause I did not, I feel like I didn't know that very well. Right. Like that, like, primary emotions tell us about our needs, and secondary emotions protect us. They rescue us from our primary emotions when those primary emotions feel too threatening. Right, like, if my daughter runs into the street, you're gonna see me get mad. I'm gonna be like, Journey, I'll yell at her. I'll, like, maybe if I'm right there, I'll grab her arm and pull her into the street, and I'll, like, frown, and my face will be red, but you can't run, right? Like, so I'm angry because my primary emotion was fear, and I can't stand the idea, the image of her getting hit by a car that flashes in my mind, and that's too scary to be with the fear, and so anger comes and rescues me from that experience. I think one is for us as therapists at the very minimum, but certainly, like, our hope is for our patients to understand, like, we're trying to help our clients better identify their emotions, understand their emotions, and manage them. But an essential part, like that's most psychotherapies of any form, is like identify, understand, and manage. And the understand part, I think what's key is understanding, is it primary or secondary? Is this like, if this emotion is primary, if fear is saying, hey, there's a threat, then run away. Like the way to manage that emotion is to run away. Right. If I feel sad, sadness is saying that something important is lost and missing. Then I need to go pursue the thing that's lost and missing, or try to replace it in some way. Or if it's shame, it's like primary shame is saying if you do this thing, you're going to get rejected or judged. Right. I think before there was this part of me that just felt like all of these emotions, I just need to make them go away without much distinction for whether they're primary or not. But like primary shame is like why I don't fart on podcasts or when I'm teaching, right? Because it would actually get me judged and rejected. So it's like, no, hold it in, wait, right? Because you're going to get judged and rejected. And, you know, guilt is trying to say like you did something that goes against your values, right? Like, so recognizing that there's primary and secondary emotions. And I think that what happens with trauma over time, traumatic invalidation, and actually like capital T trauma, is that it pairs our primary emotions with helplessness, right? I think that most of my clients, when I do an intake with my clients, most of the time I start with a really open-ended question. So it'll be the parents, usually like one of the caregivers or both of them, and then a child. And I'll start with a super open-ended question. I'll ask, like, what brings you in here? And I just want to start, I ideally want the kid to speak first, and they'll start talking. And I'm trying to collect stories, right? I'm trying to collect examples of what's going on and trying to figure out what's missing for them, ultimately. Because what I found is my kids who need DBT, right? My kids who are self-harming, who have an eating disorder, who are like using drugs, who are skipping school, who are dissociating, who are having panic attacks and avoiding situations, like, and doing all of those things. Like, these kids oftentimes at its core, often there's a primary emotion of sadness for these kids. And sadness, again, is the emotion when it's primary that says something really important to you is lost and missing. And that could be close relationships. That could be a meaningful career, right? That could be some form of connection that they want and don't have. And they've tried over time to try to pursue that, to get that thing, right? Like there's something missing, meaningful activities, meaningful relationships, meaningful connections. They've tried and they fail, either because they're blocked by their environment, they're invalidated by their environment, they are they've experienced trauma. And so when you, sadness says something's missing, you try to get it, you get blocked, then you feel helpless and out of control. Sadness says something's lost and missing, you try to get it, you get invalidated, you feel helpless and out of control. Sadness says something's missing, you try to go get it, you are unable or you're traumatized, helpless and out of control, until eventually, just like Pavlov's classical conditioning, right? It's just like light, meat powder, saliva, light, meat powder, saliva, until at some point, like, you don't even need the meat powder anymore. Just like these two things get fused. As soon as you feel sad, boom, you feel helpless and out of control, because of kind of like what I described briefly in that biosocial model, because there's been so much invalidation. When you do say, here's what I need, here's what, like, I'm trying to get this thing that's lost and missing, this connection, this, then it's just like sadness, invalidation, out of control. And again, I don't want to say it's just invalidation. Like some of our folks have experienced like long-term trauma too, have experienced. And some of our folks also, even when I think about like sadness, like being blocked, I think about like some of my folks who are on the spectrum, right? And have autism, or who have like really severe ADHD, not the kind of ADHD where like now I just feel like, I feel like, it's like 50% of my college students have ADHD. I'm like, come on. Right, like that type of ADHD, I think, is just like the demand of our society has gotten so intense that like the average mind can't keep up. Mine certainly can't, right? Like, but like actual ADHD where like the kid can't like stay in class even, that like that the sadness is saying I want something, and then there's these conditions, like neurologically based conditions, that are blocking them, and then they feel helpless. And so it fuses helplessness with, right? That's what invalidation does. It fuses these primary emotions. And so then what ends up happening is we end up using secondary emotions to rescue us from feeling helpless and out of control, because it's awful. Feeling helpless and out of control is a horrible feeling. And that's where our clients come in and they've got anger. When I'm angry, I'm attacking, I'm defending myself. I don't feel helpless. I don't feel out of control because I'm like defending myself. I'm like, I don't know, I'm cutting off relationships. I'm having big conflict. I'm being aggressive, right? Like, and so I need those behaviors of conflict and aggression and cutting off relationships because that regulates my anger. But I need anger because without anger, I feel helpless and out of control. Or anxiety, right? Like our clients come in with lots of anxiety. This is why it feels like whack-a-mole in therapy with clients with chronic invalidation, is because the secondary emotion is here to rescue them, and it's anxiety. And it says, you feel helpless out of control. Boom. When I'm anxious, I don't feel helpless out of control because anxiety gives me something to try to avoid and prevent, right? Like anxiety disorders are defined by making rules. Like when I make all these rules, it regulates my anxiety, but I need my anxiety. Otherwise, I'm feeling helpless out of control. Or we dissociate, right? Like our clients will literally, like I did an intake this past Monday and a client was just like multiple times I had to be like, it seems like you just checked out for a second. The kid was feeling super overwhelmed by this session, right? So dissociating helps regulate that. And it's because, right, but they need their anxiety. Otherwise they're gonna feel helpless out of control. Or they avoid situations, or they isolate themselves. Doing those things regulates anxiety. Or they obsess and ruminate and just sit there and even get like really philosophical, right? Where they'll be like, I don't know, I feel like a lot of philosophers were like actually like super sad dudes, and you know, and they just like, they would like get really intellectual, they'd like hyper-rationalize as a way to regulate anxiety, and the anxiety was rescuing them from feeling out of control and helpless of getting their core needs met. And they will engage in OCD. Our clients will be there washing their hands or checking or counting, and when they're doing that behavior, it regulates their anxiety, but their anxiety is needed, otherwise they're feeling helpless out of control. Or an eating disorder or substance use. These are behaviors that, or perfectionism, right? Like half of my patients are at these really, really high achieving schools. When I try to be perfect, I feel a little bit less anxious, but I need my anxiety. So we have this twisted relationship where our anxiety is our coping mechanism. Our Axis 1 disorders are a way of coping with our trauma, right? There's like a functional component to our symptoms, right? And it's super easy to see in some disorders. Like if you look at like the criteria for borderline personality disorder, it's so easy to see those 9 behaviors are emotion regulation strategies. Like that is essentially you're describing. This is how the client is trying to regulate their emotions. It's problematic in some ways, and yet in the short term, they each work and they serve that emotion regulation function. And so this is why it feels like whack-a-mole. If all you do is you pull out a protocol for a chronically invalidated and traumatized client, and you boom, you do like exposure and response prevention for the OCD, something else, an eating disorder has come out. You help them with their binging and purging. Oh, all of a sudden a substance use disorder comes out. Now you do like an evidence-based treatment for substance use, and then boom, like now they're self-harming. And then you do. And so it feels like whack-a-mole because those disorders and their symptoms are helping to regulate anxiety, but anxiety is needed because it's rescuing them as a secondary emotion from feeling helpless and out of control, as well as shame. I think shame is like the third most common secondary emotion that I see my clients presenting with. My client comes in, they feel helpless out of control. Shame lets them not feel out of control because they can blame themselves, right? They can tell themselves like, this is all my fault. Like I screwed up. Like, and if it's all my fault, then like, that's kind of synonymous with it's in my control, right? Like if I caused all of that, if I'm the reason that my parents can't get along, if I'm the reason that like financially we're like struggling, if I'm the reason that whatever the thing is, then they, and shame is so tricky because it's, I guess all of these behaviors are very short lasting. When I use shame to not feel out of control and helpless, it's, you're looking for that brief moment where you get a hit. And what that means is just for 30 seconds, even maybe just for like 60 seconds, you believe fully, this is all my fault. But actually there's relief in that, because if it's all my fault, then I maybe could snap my fingers and make it all better, because then it would be in my control if it's all my fault. And so our clients will, like, I guess now I'm finally getting to answer your question, Kitty. Like 45 minutes later, like what happens with our clients then is they're using the long-term consequences of invalidation, traumatic invalidation, of being blocked by their environment or their own like limitations, or actual trauma like assault, neglect, that over time what that teaches them is they have a really hard time staying with their primary emotion. It gets fused with out of control. Anxiety, shame, anger comes to rescue them, and then there's a whole slew of behaviors, many of which are like Axis 1 disorders, that they use to regulate those secondary emotions. And if someone stays in their in this trauma network, right, this secondary emotion and their related behaviors, if they keep like slingshotting into that way of coping with feeling helpless and out of control, then what eventually happens is the people get depressed, right? Like at that point, depression steps in and says, from a very functional, like from an evolutionary perspective, what's the function of depression?
Slow down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? So depression is saying like, yeah, conserve resources, reflect on what you're doing. Like, is this an appropriate strategy to get your needs met? And we don't have Costco and we don't have refrigerators in caveman time, so they can't waste calories for a long time on stuff that's not going to work. So like people who are able to get depressed would live longer, because when they're doing something that's not working, instead of keep trying, they would like sit back, go to their cave, kind of like cry a little, reflect, and like use their prefrontal cortex to try to solve the problem and come up with a different solution. Depression is super functional. It's saying, hey, what you're doing is not working. Like, this is a hopeless way of trying to get your needs met. Washing your hands is never going to help you have the connections that you want. Like, cutting yourself, drinking, like, you know, I don't mean like never drinking, but like, you know, like where you are depending on substances, or where you are like hyper-rationalizing, like anger. These behaviors are not going to ultimately get your needs for connection, for meaning met. And so depression says, I've got to shut it all down. Right. So, all right, that's a lot of words. I don't know.
That was riveting, Marcus. I feel like 800 light bulbs went off. It was like things I kind of knew, but it was put in such an elegant and clear way. So I really enjoyed your 45-minute monologue personally. When we think about the biosocial model and talk about traumatic invalidation, there's so much focus on the parents. But I'm wondering how more environmental invalidation comes in, like racism, poverty, bullying, even if you have a great family structure.
Yeah. It's so central. Think about, like, I don't know how to pronounce this person's name, Riff, R-Y-F-F. Like, Riff had this, like, six-factor model for, like, psychological well-being. And, like, what makes someone well was, like, positive relationships, right? Like meaningful connections, like personal, like a sense of mastery, like being able to like do the things that matter to them, have a sense of autonomy and agency, right? Like having a sense of purpose and meaning. And that makes me think of like Maslow's hierarchy, like personal growth and development. Those are the things that are needed for well-being. You know what else is needed for well-being is like attachment, like healthy attachments, which doesn't just come from parents. Like, what is attachment when you boil it down to its essence? Is this idea that I have confidence that I'm going to get my needs met. And it's easy to say like, oh, a baby's crying. Like, it gains attachment because it's figured out, like, when I cry, someone comes and soothes me and gives me. But like, things like systemic racism leave some people thinking rightfully, like it's not like a distorted thought, but that like, I'm not confident that my needs will be met. In fact, I think that many of my needs will be whatever is the opposite of not met. They're going to be like, I don't know, I'm running out of words, but yeah. Like, and so this idea of what leads to wellness, is what sadness is pointing us to, right? Sadness is saying like, you need these things. And then society, or just many different, it doesn't have to be parents, is basically saying no mastery, no like positive relationships, because you can't just have a good relationship with your parents and be happy and well adjusted, right? Mm-hmm. There are very few things that are necessary for like wellness and well-being, and having a few good friends is necessary. I need to be dialectical, but like I also don't want to be dialectical. I like when I tell my clients, like, you don't need 50 friends. But if you don't have a friend, that is not going to work. And that's not in parents' control, whether or not their kid has a friend. So the parents could do this great job. And then, like, I just got this new client who, on the first day of college, said something that was not appropriate, not sensitive, and it was hurtful to a group of people, and has since been shunned. Like, it became pretty public that this person said this, and is now like a junior in college and is really struggling to make connections. And a big consequence is they said this thing, and now they're having a really hard time making friends. They've got the scarlet letter on them, you know.
I know you can't say what it is, but what? Give us a little hint. Now
I will not. I will not.
I want to hear the juice.
I'm asking right, after this podcast is over, though.
I will. I'll spill the tea. But I think, I totally forgot what question I was answering.
how environmental.
Oh, it's not just parents.
Yeah, it's not just parents. Yeah.
The reason we focus on parents, though, is because we have more agency over that, right? Like, it's interesting because what I just described is what's the problem. It's that trauma pairs a primary emotion with helplessness, right? Chronic invalidation pairs primary emotions with helplessness. And that includes another really common scenario that I see is that my clients have primary anger. Anger is the emotion that says, you need to assert yourself. You need to defend yourself. But there's some people in some contexts who are raised where they assert themselves, and guess what happens? They're like, you shouldn't be talking like that, mm-hmm. right? Like, you shouldn't be wanting like that. You shouldn't be acting like that. You're acting privileged, or you're acting. And so they're like, oh shoot. Like, and when they try to act effectively, advocate for themselves, they get shut down. They get punished. And so over time they're shaped. My anger is saying, someone is crossing my boundaries, but when I actually express my anger, boom, invalidation, or boom, even worse, trauma. Like, I get punched upside the side of my face by someone when I tried to assert myself. And over time, that then similarly gets paired. Primary anger gets paired with feeling helpless and out of control, right? I would say those are the two most common scenarios I see, is clients who have primary sadness, primary anger. Trauma pairs that with helplessness, and then these secondary emotions come to rescue them from having to not feel out of control and helpless. And I guess I was talking about agency, but like what I think that means for our treatment, and I'm going to come back to parents, but what that means for our treatment is, like, first off, we have to use evidence-based, we don't have to. We, as members of the cognitive behavioral research and treatment program at Duke, need to first use evidence-based treatments to reduce the intensity, the frequency of those behaviors that they're using to regulate their secondary anger, shame, sad, like anxiety, right? Like, so we need to help them with their, like, use distress tolerance skills, essentially, so that they're not engaging in eating disordered behaviors, so they're not engaging in self-harm, so they're not engaging in obsessed, you know, OCD behaviors or you know, whatever, like isolation and situational avoidance and dissociation. So yes, we use distress tolerance skills to reduce the frequency of those behaviors. And then we use emotion regulation skills to help them figure out how to identify their emotions, understand, is this primary or secondary, and then manage it. If it's primary, then just do what the emotion is telling you to do. If it's secondary, then act opposite to that secondary anxiety that is only serving the function of protecting you from feeling helpless and out of control, but isn't actually telling you anything important about your environment, right? But if that's where we stop, and I think that that's where a lot of, like, therapists will stop, is they'll reduce the behavior that's used to regulate the secondary emotion, which is used to escape from and rescue them from the helplessness. And then if you stop there, and all you do is you take away these coping mechanisms, now our clients are just left feeling helpless and out of control, right? Because that's what was rescuing them from feeling helpless and out of control. That's when you might actually have a client who attempts or commits suicide, right? That's when, because now there's nothing there to rescue them from feeling that. So an effective treatment doesn't just reduce these behaviors, doesn't just help them to identify and understand what's primary and secondary and respond, you know, manage those appropriately. An effective treatment has to increase a person's sense of agency, right? Because essentially the feelings of helplessness and out of control is feeling no agency. this is the hardest part of my job, honestly. Like, I feel like using distress tolerance skills, teaching emotion regulation skills, reducing those behaviors and those secondary emotions is not as hard as it used to be, right, before for me. What's like what I do is hardest is figuring out what is simultaneously going to be an agency building activity to counter the feelings of helplessness out of control. Because if all you do is take away the coping that is provided by secondary emotions, then people are out of control and helpless. And I guess I can give you an example, maybe you'll remember this, so of what that looks like and why it's so tricky to figure out. So what, 8 years ago now, my son had a really major catastrophic traumatic brain injury. And I was so depressed afterwards. Kibby remembers, like, there was a few times I went to her house. It was just like, I was in such a low place. It was so, so painful. And primary emotion, my primary sadness was saying, I really, really don't want my son to be like this, right? Also though, primary sadness, and like, was also saying, of the many things I lost, one of the things that I lost in that situation was I thought I wouldn't be able to travel again, and I love to travel. I've been more than 80 countries. I'm going to Singapore, Japan next month, and that will be my 90th country. I love to travel. And one of the thoughts, I mean, everyone says, like, who likes to travel? Raise your hand. Like, everyone does, but like, not everyone equally. Like, I sacrificed everything for that. Like, I did not come from a family of privilege that would make that possible. But one of the things that I did when I was feeling really, really like helpless and out of control in my son's condition is I did engage in secondary anger and shame and anxiety behaviors. And one of the ways that I increased agency, because I thought this financially ruined me, number one, it really was hard. And secondly, I just thought, like, I'm trapped. Like, my son has so many needs. I can't leave the country for more than like 3 days. And there's so many places in the world you can't go if you're not going to be there for 2 weeks. And what I would do is I would open lots of credit cards for me and my wife, like 7 credit cards for me and my wife in one day. So like 14 cards in a day. And then like they would say, like, spend $5,000 and we'll give you 3 nights at any Ritz-Carlton, or spend, you know, $6,000 and we'll give you 100,000 American airline miles. And so I'd have these like 14 credit cards and I would have to spend like $60,000 or something, like $70,000 in 3 months, which, by the way, I was a grad student at Duke, so I was making $22,000 a year, and I would have to spend $70,000 in 3 months. And so I would take my new credit cards and I'd buy Visa gift cards, and then I'd take the Visa gift cards and I'd go to Walmart and I'd buy money orders with them, and then I'd take the money order and I'd put it into my checking account, and then I'd use the checking account and I'd pay off my credit card, and the credit card comes like, yay, you spent $5,000, and a week later, like, yay, you paid us back $5,000, here's your free stuff. That was my agency building activity, because that I was collecting millions of miles, right? Like, I couldn't travel. I didn't travel for years after my son's accident. I remember the first time I went somewhere, it was just so epic. Like, it was so amazing, but I had collected wild amounts of miles. Like, and when I felt totally helpless and out of control, my agency building activity, again, it doesn't actually change that much about my situation, but what it told me is I'm not fully out of control. I can buy a Visa gift card. I can buy a money order. I can, like, pay back this card. I can collect these miles. I can, and it was something that prevented me from needing these other ways of coping, right? Like, of using anxiety and anger and shame, so that I didn't have to use all of those associated behaviors that then regulate the anxiety and anger and shame and blow up marriages and, right, like, so instead of, like, getting mad at my wife, I'd buy $50,000 in gift cards, right? Like, this, and so figuring out what is going to be an agency building activity that is small, and that's what's so hard, is it doesn't actually solve the problem. I'm still in this really dark, depressed place, and I have a stack of gift cards that I need to unload onto money orders, right? So, like, it gives me some agency. We have to figure out how to do that for our clients. And with clients who are minors and dependent financially or in other ways, agency building activities are so often related to their parents, because they do in fact have little agency, right? Like, if I was 17, I couldn't be opening all these credit cards. Like, there's So like I would have needed more and more creativity from my environment to figure out what is a behavior that while I am simultaneously using distress tolerance skills to reduce my urges of self-harm or of dissociation or of washing my hands or of binging and purging, that I'm also like using opposite action to my anxiety. So that what? So that I can like replace that with something, even however small, that reminds me I'm not fully out of control, so that over time I can build more and more agency so that I can actually stay with my sadness, listen to it, and either find a way to like get back what's missing or replace it with something similar or radically accept like, yeah, I've lost that thing and I can still have a meaningful life without it, without needing to feel totally helpless and out of control, because I've now radically accepted that. It doesn't feel like that blockage anymore. It feels like a, yes, this is how it is. I wish it wasn't, and it is. I think that maybe this is like a really long way. I hope this was the question you're asking, because it took me 30 minutes to answer. But I feel like in what way are parents involved is like sometimes they've got to be a part of building, of helping kids identify an agency building activity that can replace even just, all it has to do is tell you that you're not fully out of control. You can still feel mostly out of control, but identifying agency building activities for our clients is the most compassionate thing we can do when it's done in the context of using distress tolerance and emotion regulation to do opposite action and to resist, you know, urges associated with their secondary emotions.
When I hear all this stuff, I'm like, okay, great. In order to help people in my life who feel like have been chronically invalidated or depressed or are kind of feeling out of control with their emotions, I help them build agency. Awesome. Then I'm like, how do I do that? Right? Like as a parent or, you know, as a wife, right? How do it's hard to, I can imagine it's hard to help someone else feel agency, right? The,
yes.
So what is like the tip of like, what do I do now? You know?
Yeah. I think one thing is to not judge, right? Like, it's like, the model that I've described, it's similar to Seligman's learned helplessness, mm-hmm. right? Like, and learned helplessness is the idea that learned helplessness is a learned response to not being able to escape a situation, to being traumatized, right, to feeling out of control. And this passive, we've come full circle, we're back to motivation with teenagers, right? This passive, helpless, unmotivated demonstration that you have is actually a default response to this prolonged stress, this chronic invalidation. Like that is actually a learned response. It's a default response. And so the follow-up studies, they said that it actually wasn't that they learned helplessness. Really what happened is that they failed to learn how to escape from extreme stress in ways that are effective, right? These dogs didn't, and maybe you can put a link to like a description of the learned helplessness studies, but these dogs didn't learn to be helpless behaviors. They just failed to learn effective escape behaviors from really extreme stress. From really, and in the case of these kiddos and or of our family members, so I think one thing is like to have compassion, like start with like, I guarantee their behavior makes sense if I could fully understand it, and that's really really hard because we're so attached to our loved ones being happy, being I don't know like so, but I think starting from a place of acceptance is one thing that I think is helpful. Another thing that I think is helpful is to understand the function of emotions. Like what I said, like that there's primary and secondary emotions. I think that as loved ones, we can be curious about, is this primary and it's telling them something? Because a lot of times as loved ones, we're similar to like rookie therapists. When I was a rookie therapist, I saw a client that felt shame, I wanted them to not feel shame. I saw a client who felt guilty, I wanted them to not feel guilty. I didn't really distinguish. Like, was your anxiety justified? Is it in fact something that you did that's against your values? Then your guilt is justified. I need to help you manage your guilt, but that doesn't mean suppressing it. It means we need to make a repair, right? Or like, so I think for loved ones to understand, there is this idea of primary and secondary emotions, where primary emotions tell us about our needs and secondary emotions are trying to help us escape when those primary emotions feel too threatening. That way we can help our loved ones try to reduce and escape and act opposite to their secondary emotions, and help them to lean into and be motivated by their primary emotions? I know it's a lot to ask. It's basically saying, like, be a first or second year, you know, clinician. And yet, but that's the question you asked, so I'm going to answer. I think another thing is to not be super, super focused on symptoms, right? Like, think of them as tools that people use to regain a sense of control. I think that's helpful, because so many times the parents who come to me, or even the spouses that come to me to talk about their loved one, there's so much focus on the behaviors that show up in the DSM. And I think if we could focus on that as they're using this to regain a sense of control, what is it that they're feeling out of control for? If we could actually go to solve that problem, then we don't need, like, then that person will no longer need the anxiety. And when they don't need the anxiety, they're not going to need the OCD and the eating disorder and the substance use, because they now have that sense of control coming from elsewhere. And I think what else can loved ones do? What do you guys think? I guess I'm curious. I want to learn too.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine what is more tough is that, let's say I am a partner of someone and they express their secondary emotion through anger and they yell at me, or they, or like verbally abusive, or they, you know, tell us that it would make them feel better if we don't go out, or if we don't talk to our friends, or just be ourselves, right? Like if they're trying to regulate their emotions with harmful behavior to us, it's really hard for us to then say, oh, yeah, let's, no judgment. Well, what are you feeling? Let's totally validate and give you agency around that. I mean, I can imagine that, you know, we're just human beings. We're just like, how do I do that while feeling like totally attacked myself? You know, imagine with teenagers who are also experiencing this, right? They're like screaming at their parents, and their parents are supposed to be like calm, validating, also get them to school, right? It's tough.
Yeah. And I guess, like, here's the cliche is, like, you've got to be able to manage your own emotions, right? The whole, like, put on your own mask. Like, if you're trying to help someone who is stuck in their trauma network, meaning that those secondary emotions and the ways that they cope with those secondary emotions, if you see your loved one stuck in their trauma network, they're washing their hands, they're dissociating, they're binging, they're restricting, they're whatever it is. Step one is being mindful about, like, what that brings up for you. It's so interesting. I'm not gonna talk too much about it, but, like, I live with my mother-in-law, and the tricky thing is, what activates my wife's trauma network is related to her mom, and her reaction to her trauma network being activated leads to her mom. Like, and that's what ends up happening. Most of the time, I didn't get her permission. I'm not gonna share her business. But let me think about an example that's my own that I can share, of, like, how, like, our trauma networks are intertwined. It's like this person feels unappreciated, and that is something that, you know, like, so that they, for some reason, the only thing that's coming to my mind is, like, my wife and her mom, because we had that kind of morning. But I think that one of the things that we, in the ideal scenario, is that we recognize when it's happening. We're like, oh shoot, like, I just feel like I'm trying to control things right now. And for the other person to be like, oof, when I see you trying to control things, I want to control things. Like, I want to control the way that you're trying to control things. And just recognizing that oftentimes that there's a vortex that draws us in. So step one is, like, be mindful of how your own trauma network is getting activated as you're trying to support other people to, like, escape the vortex of their own trauma network. And so that means be mindful of, like, act opposite to your own anger urges or your own shame urges, your own anxiety urges. Identify, like, use distress tolerance to not act on those. Identify, what are you feeling? Try to figure out, is it primary or secondary? And then manage it accordingly. Like, once you've done that, then you can potentially come into the situation, provide the validation that is so needed, that like, oh, it totally makes sense that you are doing this thing right now. Like, my wife and I are like, we go through different phases, but we're going through like a Haagen-Dazs green tea ice cream phase, right? And we will just like pound it instead of dinner. Like, I have no problem with ice cream, but like that would be the dinner. And that's not in line with my values. I know it's not good for my cholesterol. I know like I end up feeling way worse. I'm like super gassy. Like there's a lot of, and so like recognizing like, why am I having super strong urges right now to eat green tea? Or even worse, like, why are you feeling such strong urges to try to control what I do or don't eat? Recognizing that is maybe one of the most helpful things, because once we've regulated our own emotions, our own, taking care of our own vulnerabilities, are mindful of our own judgments that are fueling our emotional reactions, then we can validate. And then going all the way back to that like biosocial model, when we can validate, it leads to more emotion regulation, which leads to more accurate expression, right? Which leads to us being more, feeling more regulated and soothed, which makes it easier for us to validate, which makes it easier for them to feel regulated, which makes it easier for them to express accurately. Like that's the goal. And so we've got to figure out like, what are our entry points as loved ones? And we've really only got two entry points: regulate our own emotions and validate. But actually, when we're really dysregulated, we only have one. We've got to first regulate our emotions so that validation is even possible.
How do you know? Okay. I mean, I think when you have a family member, there is who's been chronically invalidated, it makes a lot of sense to keep trying forever.
Yeah.
When you have a friend or a partner, though, whose symptoms of this are essentially abusive or just really dysregulating, like, okay, I have a patient who tends to text her friends and providers over and over and over and over and over again and just like blast them with her emotions. How do you set limits with those types of people? How do you know when enough is enough? Is there a way to set limits in a way that doesn't feed into the invalidation cycle?
I think one of the things that I'll speak to myself. How about that? One of the things that I do is I give myself permission now. Sometimes I know when my wife really needs validation, and mm-hmm. she's very accurate. She'll say, Marcus, I had this really difficult experience with a patient or with one of our colleagues or something, or like, you know, with, and she'll say, I had this thing. But the thing that she's describing is also bringing up some of my own emotion dysregulation. And so a part of what I do is I say, Julia, I feel like you really, really want validation from me right now. And I think that's like what you really, really need. I honestly feel like emotionally, I'm not regulated enough to be able to provide that. Like I in my wisest mind, I know that's what's needed and I want to provide that. I can't right now. Like, I'm getting ready for a podcast right now, or I'm, you know, like, I'm driving to session while doing a phone coaching call and I'm trying to outline the talk that I'm going to give tonight. Like, whatever it is, like, I've just got, or I just like, I haven't eaten, I have a headache. Like, I'm not in a place where I can give you what I know you need. Mm-hmm. And that way you make it about yourself. It's like, I can't do what you need because I can't yet regulate my emotions well enough to be able to show up for you in the ways that you need. And maybe the best thing I can do is to not make it worse, because I feel like when you're describing this problem, I just want to jump in and give solutions. Mm-hmm. And I know that's not going to be super helpful right now. I know that you have way more wisdom than I do about this problem, but you just really need someone to say, shit, that super sucks. Like, that's really messed up. Like, I'm so sorry that happened. I can't believe they did that. Like, that's so wild and hard and ugh. And really, and my wife is like, there's no bullshitting her. If you don't feel it, but you say those words, they're useless. And I know that. Like, if this was like someone else, I might be able to get away with it, like a colleague at work, where I could like say the words and be like, oh, Marcus gets it. Like, there's no BSing my wife. Like, if I'm not actually validating her And so I've just decided, like, oh, Julia, I feel like, and this just literally just happened a few days ago, but we do this a lot now. I just say, like, oh, I think you really, and it's so hard because the moments that she really needs validation, she needs it then. And I just have to be like, I'm so sorry. I really can't, like, I know you need that, and I can't. I'm feeling a lot of my own stuff. In fact, and I don't say this to her, but, like, I'm feeling stuff about what you're saying. Like, I want to validate you, and I also want to point out that I think that, like, you mismanaged that situation. Like, we had this, like, scheduling situation, and, like, in this book, and, like, double booked two rooms for therapy, and she was looking for validation, but in reality, as I collected more data, I realized, like, she had made the mistake. Believe it or not, it was the first time since I've known her, but she made the mistake. And I knew, like, saying that right then wasn't going to be effective. And so, and yet, like, because all I'm seeing is, like, Julia, like, if you had done this other thing that I told you to do before, then we wouldn't have this problem now. And, like, yes, the way that the person responded to being double booked, that was, like, super messed up. But I can't validate that because I'm having these other thoughts, too. So, yeah, that was a really long way of saying, like, you've got to regulate your emotions and give yourself permission to not provide validation if you can't.
Marcus, that was awesome. That was really, it's cool to kind of see the way you're seeing all these, like, how chronic validation can really, it almost kind of, like, it could explain a lot of different symptoms. So it's really relieving probably for people to hear that when they are struggling with all sorts of stuff, right? Like anxiety, and you said, like, OCD hand washing, and they also drink, and they also have, you know, and those people can kind of feel like, this is so hopeless. Why am I so crazy? Why am I so broken? But it makes sense to kind of boil it down to, oh, I feel like my vulnerable feelings, the primary feelings, are overwhelming. And I'm doing all sorts of things to kind of get away from it. And so it's not like a million problems, it's one. And there's some simple steps of, it's not simple, but it's at least a path forward of trying to find agency around those moments, trying to accurately describe and express how I'm feeling in that moment so that you're actually meeting your needs and not just, like, doing a bunch of stuff to cover it up. So I love that. Do you have any books or resources or links, or let's say someone's listening right now and they want to delve into this more and they go, oh my gosh, I don't know what any of this stuff is. What would I start with my kid who's just, like, screaming 10 times a day? What do I do? Or you could also direct them to any of what you guys going on or your center.
I do think DBT is such a helpful treatment. So I think that, like, if the model that I just described resonates with someone here, then I'm not saying it's the only approach, but a treatment that you might find to be helpful is dialectical behavior therapy. Not like some of the skills in DBT, not like a therapist who's informed by DBT, but actually someone who's doing full model DBT. I think that's one thing. And maybe similar to that is watch as many videos as you can online about validation. It is so hard to do. It's hard to validate others. It's hard to validate ourselves. And there's a lot of tools surrounding regulating emotions, right? Like, I just feel like there's so much on the internet about how to regulate emotions. There's a lot less on the internet about how to validate. I'm actually doing a grand rounds talk at UCLA for their, like, STAR seminar in November. And it's going to be like an hour and a half lecture on validation. Like, cool. So that'll probably be posted and it'll be available for free online and on YouTube. Like, watch stuff like that. Like, I think that's got the meat that people need to both not invalidate their loved ones and how to self-validate and heal from invalidation, you know, when that's already what's happening for someone. So I would say, like, looking up not just what it is and, like, how it's lacking for me, but, like, how can I do it? Like, the how-tos of validation.
Awesome. There's an Instagram account called Dr. Becky at Good Inside. I don't know if you've heard of her, Marcus, but she really demonstrates a lot of what you're talking about in parenting tips. So that's nice.
And is there any way that people can learn more about you and your work and reach out if they have questions? Or
yeah, I do trainings for mental health professionals on like this type of therapy. I do trainings in mostly in China and in Latin America, because there's very few people that know how to do this treatment in China. And I do some of that in Spanish too. And so I'm happy to do things in the US. It's just, there's so many people that can do what I do in the US. But yes, if you want training, I'm here for it. You can contact me at the Youth and Family Institute. If there's people who are in California and they're wanting this treatment, then they could reach out also to the Youth and Family Institute.
Well, to be honest, I think that Kibby and I have been demonstrating some symptoms of chronic invalidation ourselves. I mean, Kibby hasn't been able to put on her pants because she's been throwing temper tantrums. I have been crying hysterically every time Mufasa dies. And it's because we don't have enough 5-star ratings on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you all really want to help, what you can do is give us a 5-star comment and please leave us some validation in the comment section as well. And we'll see you next week.
By accessing this podcast, I acknowledge that the hosts of this podcast make no warranty, guarantee, or representation as to the accuracy or sufficiency of the information featured in this podcast. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at your own risk. This podcast and any and all content or services available on or through this podcast are provided for general, non-commercial informational purposes only and do not constitute the practice of medical or any other professional judgment, advice, diagnosis, or treatment, and should not be considered or used as a substitute for the independent professional judgment, advice, diagnosis, or treatment of a duly licensed and qualified healthcare provider. In case of a medical emergency, you should immediately call 911. The hosts do not endorse, approve, recommend, or certify any information, product, process, service, or organization presented or mentioned in this podcast, and information from this podcast should not be referenced in any way to imply such approval or endorsement.